So Judges chapter 7 and starting at verse 1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people. Anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say, 'This one shall go with you,' he shall go. But if I say, 'This one shall not go with you,' he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During that night the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up. Go down against the camp, because I am going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah, and listen to what they are saying. Afterwards, you will be encouraged to attack the camp." So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outposts of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the other eastern peoples had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. "I had a dream," he was saying. "A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "This can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands." Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. Grasping the torches in their left hands and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow, they shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shitta towards Zerirah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah near Tabath. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters of the Jordan ahead of them as far as Beth Barah." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they took the waters of the Jordan as far as Bethbara. They also captured two of the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. They pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon, who was by the Jordan.
Well, very good morning to you, and welcome to Cornerstone Church. We're continuing our series working through the book of Judges, and we're now on part two of Gideon. Let me pray, and then we'll dive in. Mighty, powerful Lord, you are the great deliverer. You've given us your word. We thank you for it. And we pray, Lord, that this morning wouldn't just be interesting stories, exciting stories, but would be living truth that changes us. Lord, please, will you help us to be willing to change? And will you please work that change in us with the help of your Holy Spirit this morning? We ask this for your glory. Amen. Well, here's a question. Have you ever felt powerless? Have you ever felt, really powerless? You ever stood before a task for which you felt completely inadequate? You ever felt that the odds are stacked entirely against you so that you don't even know where to start? Like a graduate who's just got his degree, got his first job, and then he opens the property pages, for Kingston. And he says, that's never going to happen. You ever felt that sort of complete impotence? Confronted with the task before you, your weakness has become all too apparent. Now, if you're anything like me, you hate that feeling. Powerlessness. You want to have all of the answers. You want to be sort of masterful and confident and heroic, but you aren't, and it frustrates you. Can you relate to that? And then you look at others and they seem to have it all together. You ever look around yourself at all these wonderful people out there? And Christians feel this very acutely, I think, don't we? So there's a world out there. We know there's a world out there that desperately needs to hear the Christian message. They desperately need to hear the gospel. And yet we look at ourselves and we look at this city and we feel so few. And we feel like we're so ineffective. And then you hear of millions over there somewhere in Asia getting saved every day. Yeah? You ever get that? I felt it this week. We did, again, same scenario happens. We did our Christianity Explored course and one non-Christian turns up. And you just look at yourself and you think, one. And then you hear reports over the other side of the Atlantic of an Easter Day service where they had 17,000 people, had to hire a football stadium, and 700 people got baptised. So what am I doing wrong, I ask myself. What do I have to do to see that kind of success? Why is it that when, and maybe you relate to this, when I try to talk to people, when I used to try to talk to people what I believe about at work, in the workplace, they don't all just sort of break under the conviction of the gospel and say, what must I do to be saved, Andy? They don't do that. Instead, they either come back with some smart comment or they treat you like you're nice but a little bit weird. Yeah. Do you feel that? And you wonder again, what am I missing? What am I not doing right? And endless books have been written, haven't they? You've seen them all on the shelves in the bookshops. Endless books written to try and answer that question with techniques and strategies that you can do. And there's some good stuff in there. And we probably should be aware of the stuff. And it's worth listening to a bit. But the real answer's here in the Bible. And I think you're going to see it so clearly this morning. What should you be doing? Well, here's three basic things that you can start off with. And the first one we're looking at this morning is, with success, you can click onto the next slide. With success, the first point, it's about God's glory, not our glory. First thing, I really want you to get these. It's about God's glory, not our glory. It's a simple truth. God cares far more about his glory than your glory. Read with me from verse 1. Have a look at those verses we read. Start verse 1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. So 22,000 men left, whilst 10,000 remained. Now, if you're with us, you'll remember from last time, Gideon's been on a sort of journey. God's been coaching him. And God has been manning him up. That's really what's been going on there. He's been giving him some backbone, gently, carefully, nurturing him. So at the beginning of chapter 6, you've got Gideon complaining, you know, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I'm the least in my family, you know. And then by the end of that chapter, under the gracious sort of training hand of God, having smashed up some altars and some idols, done some brave acts, having blown the trumpet to rally the Israelites against the invaders, perhaps his voice has started to take on a bit more of a, you know, a bit more of a manly tone. It's dropped a few tones. But be that or be that not, at the very least, and far more importantly, I hope you saw this last time, his faith, small as it was, is starting to grow. That's really what God's been doing in him. Started to grow that tiny little mustard seed faith of Gideon. Now, like most of you, and definitely me, there's still not really much of a heroic bone in Gideon's body. And I think you see that in this story too. I mean, yeah, he does some pretty cool stuff, but he's not really a brave man. Gideon is slowly and steadily moving from zero to hero. But it's not because he's suddenly become an amazing, you know, fearless leader of men. That hasn't happened. It's more because he's starting to realise that the Lord, the God of Israel, can really be trusted. And it's his confidence in God, not his confidence in himself, that leads him onwards into the battle. Now that's really important. Remember, I tried to allude to this a little bit last time. Faith or trust is only as effective as the object you put it in. It's a very simple, obvious statement of fact, and we miss it so often. Your faith's only as effective as what you trust in. So last year, Sarah's old Vauxhall Tigra, we loved that old car, it died somewhat catastrophically. And I took it to the garage. The bloke checked the compression in the cylinders and just said, it's zero, mate. You have actually blown a hole through the cylinder. It's completely gone. Entirely blown through the engine block. Way to go, Sarah. And Sarah found herself stranded in Bournemouth when this happened. With a car that effectively had no engine to speak of. I mean, that's really what you had there. A car with no engine. Now imagine that she'd convinced herself that what was most important was not the soundness or reliability of her vehicle, but simply the strength of her faith, how much she trusted her vehicle. Imagine this. I mean, it's mental to think this way. She would still be sat in that car right now, wouldn't she? Thinking, it's gonna go! For all the good that that would do. But it would never have got her to her destination. It's useless. No point putting your faith in that. And she would quickly have discovered then that her faith is only as effective as the object she's putting it in. No more effective. Sarah has a new car now. And it's a lovely car. I think I drive it more than she does. I've personally checked it over. I've gone over the engine. I've replaced all the gas. I love this stuff. I've gone over it. It is a really reliable car. When I read the reviews, this car was getting top marks for reliability. It's a great car. But she doesn't have to take my word for it. The car speaks for itself, doesn't it? Even if she had virtually no faith, I mean a mustard seed of faith in her new car, just enough to get in and turn the key, she'd get to work. She'd get to her destination. Do you see what I'm saying here? It's not the faith that gets her there. It's the car. It's the object of her faith. That's so important. You get that in your head, you start to understand what's going on here. What's going on in the Bible, really, with faith. I hope you're getting this. You see, trust in your own strength or in the strength of mankind, you're always going to be disappointed. Aren't you? Governments teach you that, don't they? Trust in the never-failing God who made you, and you'll never be disappointed. Never. We fail continually, don't we, as human beings? But God never does. He is trustworthy. Now, that's a lesson that God has been schooling Gideon in all along. That's really what we're seeing here. It's a lesson he's starting to learn. But the Israelites, the people he's got to lead into battle, they still need a lot more schooling in this. That's what we're going to see this week. So success and victory for Israel will not be because they are glorious, but because God is glorious. And right from the start, we learn that God is engineering this victory, this whole battle, so that it shouts that lesson loud and clear to everyone. That's what's going on. So Gideon gathers his troops. You heard the story. And all 32,000 of them, not a bad effort, they set up camp at the spring of Harod. It's just south of the valley where the Midianites are settled. And it's here that the Lord speaks to Gideon. You get a very interesting first interaction here. So Gideon's over here with his, let's say, you know, not too shabby, 32,000 men. It's not a bad effort. Midian's over there, though, with, I mean, if you look at later in chapter 8, about 135,000 men. I mean, it's quite a difference. Midian's got God's in here. So it's a 1-4 ratio here for Israel. Every man's got to take on 4 men. And not only that, but they're described in chapter 8, Midian's men, as swordsmen. Okay, we've got farmers against swordsmen on a 1-4 sort of ratio. And so God comes to Gideon. Problem Gideon, it's the numbers Gideon. There's a problem here with your men, the numbers. And Gideon sort of, you know, well, you know, I tried hard, I tried to get more. Gideon, says God, you've got too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. Look at verse 2. Yes, I know, you know, I did my best to Gideon, but hang on, wait a minute, did you say too many men? Why too many men? You have too many, says God. In order, look at verse 2, you have too many in order that God, that Israel, may not boast against me that their own strength has saved them. 1-4 is going to make it look like, Gideon, like you actually just were a bunch of heroes. 1-4. They'll all go home from the battle, won't they? And people will be erecting monuments to their glory in the town centre. Won't they? You'll have a public holiday. You'll have lots of feasts. And they'll celebrate these heroes that delivered them. We'll never hear the end of all of their boasts if we do this. Their tales of courage and valour. How they, with a little bit of assistance from the Lord, you know, admittedly, won a great victory against the enemy. That will never do, says God. We're not doing that. That way they will never learn to trust me. And it's not about their glory, it's about my glory. We must pare the numbers down until it is clear that the glory goes only to me. So what does God say? He says, anyone who trembles with fear, send them home. Anyone who's scared, send them home. And 22,000 men leave. All that work, and Gideon leaves, you know, he loses more than two-thirds of his men. So that's now 10,000. That's now 1-13. Now the odds are starting to look a little bit more how God wants them. Much more like it. Look, victory, real success in God's eyes, is all about his glory, not ours. I mean, it must be. Think about it. After all, everything that we have and everything that we are, where does it come from? It all comes from him. You get no boasting rights. Do you see that? Perhaps it's you, though. Perhaps this is you. You're like this. Perhaps you've heard the Christian message. You know, that it's outrageous, isn't it? That God offers his gift of salvation freely as a gift. He'll rescue you freely. And you just can't accept that. And you think to yourself, you know, if anyone is going to save me, who's it going to be? It's going to be me. I'm going to save me. No one else is. And you imagine that at heaven's gates, if there were gates at heaven, if those actually existed, that they would have to let you in because you're just so great. You know, it's a no-brainer. I'm getting in. But who is it that gave you your strength? Who is it that gave you that which you are boasting in? Who? Who gave you your body, your mind, your every breath, the every beat of your heart? Who gave it to you? Without God, you could do nothing. The glory goes to him. Success in God's eyes, then, is not about your glory. It's about his, because it's right. Just simply because that's right. It's all about his glory. That's the first thing. Second thing. Success, then. It's all about God's strength, not our strength. You see this in verses 4-8. You've got 10,000 regular blokes here, probably armed with, you know, like I say, farmers with pitchforks and ox goads. They seem to be popular at this time. And they're going up against 135,000 men armed with the teeth. These are proper raiders that are armed and ready to come onto a land and beat people up and push them off. They're not messing around, these Midianites, these eastern people. And things are only about to get worse for Gideon. Look at verse 4 with me. But the Lord said to Gideon, there's still too many men. Take them down to the water and I'll sift them for you there. If I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, that one will not go with you, he shall not go. Don't mess with me, Gideon. We're doing it my way. I'll tell you who's going and who's not going. Right, down to the water. Still too many. Now, can you imagine the panic that is, if you was anything like me, the panic that's starting to slowly creep into Gideon's stomach? I mean, it's weird, right? This whole situation is weird. Gideon's mustered all of his manliness. And we're not talking about much here, are we? He's blown a trumpet. He's rallied the troops. He's done the job that God has called him to do. And he's got 32,000 men responding to his call, looking pretty good. But it's vastly less than the enemy, yet he still continues onward. Then God makes him send 2/3 of them home. I mean, it's weird. It's not how you win a military campaign. And now God says there's still too many. And the story goes on. He tells them to separate them into two groups depending on how they drink out of the local stream. So we're going to watch how they drink. And at the end of this sifting process, we're left with a rather pitiful 300 men. 300. I won't tell you what the odds are there, but you can do it in your head. It's pathetic, isn't it? Now, some people think that what we've got here is a kind of sorting out and a honing of all the troops so that all you're left with is the quality, is the cream on the top. Okay, some people actually write that. That misses the text. You know, this is not a sort of Bronze Age SAS, the best of the best. So first you get rid of the fearful ones, they'd say. You know, no one who's scared, got rid of the fearful ones. Then you get rid of those who are not vigilant in the way that they drink. You know, they've got keeping an eye out for the enemy. See where they're going with this. So you're left with those who fear nothing and are alert for whatever comes their way. Could be, may I offer an alternative to this? Because this doesn't fit with the flow of the story, does it? What is God's main contention? They're not to boast about this. They're not to boast. See, not fearing the enemy could be bravery, but it could also be stupidity, couldn't it? Just as likely. And as for the way they drink, actually, people say a more likely translation seems to be that the majority there are kneeling down carefully to drink from the stream like normal people would. But these exceptional 300 are the ones who don't bother using their knees. They just go, oh, go into the water. They're the slightly mental ones. They're the kind of people that would probably just do exactly as they're told in a battle. You know, no questions asked. I'm told to drink, I'll go for it. They throw themselves into everything with total enthusiasm. That's probably the best thing you can say about them. See, I don't think it fits that they're in any way exceptional. That's not what God's looking for. He's not looking for an exceptional few here. He's looking for a weak few. They're not that few good men, the best and the brightest. They were not the strong, and that's the point. Because for Gideon, success is going to be about God's strength, not about his strength. Do you get that? Now, I meet a lot of people like this today, maybe you do. They believe in God, but they've got no idea about how he saves. They've got a different sort of pride from that first group. See, they know they've blown it as far as living up to God's standards. They're not proud in that kind of way. But they do believe they can change themselves. They can do it. It's not that they already think that they're good enough. It's that they honestly think that given enough time and effort and put enough work into it, they could be. I could be good enough. Now, religion generally appeals to that kind of person, doesn't it? Because religion gives me a structure, it gives me a list of do's and don'ts that I can use to reform myself. Only trouble is it won't work. It never works. Because all religion ever does is clean up the outside. It's like putting a band-aid on an outbreak of measles. It might make you look slightly less unsightly. But it doesn't fix the real problem. the problem inside, the problem of the heart, the root problem, the disease. And if the book of Judges has taught us anything, it's that strong as you think you are, you cannot break free from the tyranny of sin. That's that cycle over and over in the book of Judges, isn't it? They think they can, they can't. Sin will always get the better of you if all you have is your strength. So Gideon's left with his 300 men, a lot of provisions apparently, verse 8, and a big pile of trumpets. I mean, normally some swords would be handy, wouldn't they, at this point? But this whole ordeal is far from ordinary, isn't it? Perhaps a few hundred trumpets will come in useful later. We'll have to wait and see. What is Gideon to do here, though? See, his dad bailed him out of his last scrape when things got a bit hairy, didn't they? Do you remember that? But this time he's on his own. His dad's not there. So he does what any other slightly bewildered and worried military leader would. He turns in for the night. Goes to sleep. He's about to learn the third thing, you see. That victory, that success, is all about God's work, not our work. It's about God's work, not our work. That's the rest of this chapter, really. Look at verse 9 with me. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up and go against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. I'm going to give it into your hands." What happens next is so gracious of God. You know, if you know Gideon, it's so gracious. Knowing Gideon's propensity to need a lot of signs and encouragements, God sends him out on a little spy mission. See, for the Christian, saving faith is never a total leap into the dark. It's reasonable faith, because God is gracious. God graciously gives us good reasons to trust him. He doesn't need to, but he does. Think about it, just for a second. When Jesus rose from the dead, he could have just briefly showed himself to a few of the disciples and then been off to heaven, ascended. But he didn't. Listen to what Acts 1 verse 3 tells us about that particular time. He says, he showed himself to these men and gave many convincing proofs that he was alive. He gave them proofs to put their trust in. He appeared to them over a period of 40 days, spoke about the kingdom of heaven. The Apostle Paul writes that on one occasion there were 500 people there. Many convincing proofs, not a leap in the dark. Graciously, he gives us all of these convincing proofs, and that's what he does for Gideon. How else is it going to be, you see, with the disciples, that little band of men are going to be able to go out and have the confidence to go into the world and preach the gospel to all the nations, preach the message of Jesus? It's the same with Gideon here. How's he going to do it? Verse 10, if you're afraid to attack, go down into the camp, says God, with your servant Purah. Verse 11, listen to what they're saying. Afterwards, you will be encouraged to attack. It's so gracious of God, isn't it? If the prospect of taking this vast army on is worrying you, Gideon, if you're a bit concerned about these 300 that you've got here, and why wouldn't you be, let alone the prospect of leading that bunch into a battle, then go. Take a listen to what's going on in the camp. It's so wonderfully accommodating. And God's like that with us, isn't he? See, now God, look at how God accommodates Gideon. Gideon likes to do all of his brave deeds at night, doesn't he? So God sends him at night. Gideon likes to have a bit of moral support, some people around him to do it. Take your servant with you, suggests God. It's like God's preempted everything that Gideon might ask him for. Gideon likes signs. Go and have one, Gideon. Just go and have a sign. Then you'll be confident. And they arrive at the enemy camp just in time to hear a conversation. Did you catch it? It transpires that throughout the camp, men have been having a particular dream and have been chatting about it. And in this dream, they've discussed it, in this dream, a bread roll has tumbled rapidly down into the camp and smashed it up. And they've discussed that. They've rationally thought through the bread roll thing, and they've quite obviously come to the conclusion that it can mean nothing other than that God has given them all into the hands of Gideon. What a terrific dream. Never mind how they came to that conclusion, though, bizarre as it is. That's the kind of conclusion that Gideon needs to hear, isn't it? exactly what he needed to hear. And right there and then, look at it, Gideon worships God. It is such a wonderful thing. And then he hastily returns to his own camp and he wakes up the 300 and he hatches his plan. So he divides them up into three companies of 100, issues every man with, you know, a torch inside a jar and a trumpet. That's what they're taking into battle. And then he gets the men to all surround the camp, and on his signal, they're going to smash the jars. They smash the jars and they shout, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." And they blow their trumpets, and all pandemonium ensues down in the valley. It's very interesting to see what happens. I mean, have a look at it in verse 22. Did you catch what happens? The Midianites actually turn on each other, and they cut each other down. The sword of the Lord. What is the sword of the Lord? Well, it actually happens to be the sword that's in the hands of the Midianites, that they turn on each other. That's the sword God uses. It's a staggering victory. The Midianites, they draw their swords in panic, they turn on each other, and then they flee right into a number of Israelite ambushes, and they're cut down. That's what happens in the end of the chapter there. Now just for a second, stop and get the impact of what happened that night. Gideon and his 300 men, what did they actually do? They just stood. Picture it, like an audience in the theatre, all around the stage, theatre in the round, Gideon and his men all the way round, and they throw the spotlights on, as they smash their jars, on what God is about to do. They blow their trumpets to draw attention to it, and God does all of the rest. Verse 21 says, all we need to know, each man held his position, they stood still, and the Midianites ran out, they fled, screaming. Everything about this victory, can you see this? Everything about it, every detail shouts, God is glorious, God is strong, God has done it. Victory and success is not found in my work, is it? It's not in what I do, what I achieve. It's in what God does. That's the third thing. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how many people I talk to claim to be Christians. They claim to know Jesus, they claim to follow Jesus, yet they still think that the way that they're going to get to heaven is through their own work. You know, okay, I get that I'm not good enough, I get that I can't clean myself up enough, so all I can do then is work my hardest. I spoke to someone who said this week, and hope that God is impressed with me. Can you not see how that misses the gospel by a mile? You aren't good enough. You can't do anything without God. You can't improve. Sin will always be stronger than you are. And you can't please God no matter how hard you work. The Apostle Paul wrote in one of his letters that God had once encouraged him with these words. You can put this on your, if you're writing notes, here it is. Here's this story with Gideon in a sentence. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 12:9 that God said to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." It's a general principle here, isn't it? Now listen, because here is where the story of Gideon shifts a gear, lifts up. Now look down on it and see what's going on here. You see, nothing seemed weaker than the Son of God giving up his throne in heaven and being confined in a physical body, walking around on the earth. From Godhead glory ruling the universe to a man walking around, physically restricted, tirelessly serving everyone who had any need, and then being nailed to a cross. One man, rejected, mocked, beaten and killed. It's pathetic, isn't it? But what seemed weak in the eyes of mankind was the most staggering display of the power of God that the history has ever seen. God was never more glorified than when Jesus defeated Satan, sin and death as he rose triumphantly on the third day. God never showed his strength more than that day when he humiliated all the powers of evil and broke the chains of sin. And God never did more for us than when he gave his Son for us to take our punishment, to bear our sin, to pay our debts, to set us free. That's what this story is really all about. That's what it's pointing at. So come to Jesus. Leave your pride. Leave your strength. Leave behind anything you think you can take with you or bring to him, and simply come. Look, Gideon's secret of victory and success, what actually is it? It's though you are weak, God is strong. Simply obey. Simply obey him. Trust him, and he'll do the rest. Now, it's an amazing application there, but listen, there's more. Listen to how Paul goes on to apply this amazing truth. His very next sentence after he said that, he says, therefore, because God's power is made perfect in weakness, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. Now, here's something for those of you who hunger to do great things, and I hope you do. You want to do great things for God. Here's what Paul would say: embrace your weakness. Embrace your weakness. It is in the simple things that God has called you to do that his power will be most powerfully demonstrated, most perfectly demonstrated. Think of those questions right at the start. What am I doing wrong? What's the secret? Don't be disappointed. It's God's glory that matters, not yours. That's the first thing. Don't ever be disappointed. It's God's glory, not yours. You don't need more power from you. One man plus God, that's a majority. Thirdly, generally speaking, you don't need to do more either. You might do. But generally speaking, it's not about that. You need to trust more and simply obey. Listen to this fantastic story. Have you ever heard of a Sunday school teacher called Mr. Edward Kimball? Who's heard of him? Put hands up. No, I didn't think so. Good, you're not supposed to have. He's a nobody, really, isn't he? Edward Kimball. Listen, he had a boy in his Sunday school called Dwight L. Moody. This is terrific. Listen to his testimony, Edward Kimball. He says this. He says, I was determined to speak to him about Christ and about his soul, and started to go down to Holton's boot store where Moody worked. When I was nearly there, I began to wonder whether I ought to go in just then, you know, during business hours. I thought my call might embarrass the boy. In the meantime, I passed the store, and discovering this, I determined to make a dash for it and have it over at once. I found him in the back of the building wrapping up shoes. I went up to him at once. Putting my hand on his shoulder, I made what I felt afterwards was a very weak plea for Christ. Simply told him of Christ's love for him and the love Christ wanted in return. That's all there was. It seemed the young man was just ready for the light that broke upon him. And there in the back of the store in Boston, D.L. Moody gave himself and his life to Christ. D.L. Moody went on to become one of the greatest evangelists in his day. He went to England. He worked a profound change in the ministry of another man called F.B. Mayer. F.B. Mayer, with his new evangelistic fervour, influenced another man, J. Wilbur Chapman. Chapman helped in the ministry of converted baseball player Billy Sunday, great name, who also had a profound impact upon another man called Mordecai Ham. And Mordecai Ham, holding a revival in North Carolina, led Billy Graham to Christ. Isn't that amazing? My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Let's pray. Father, it is such an encouragement to us that you are not looking for a few good men. You're not looking for mighty, powerful men. You're looking for ordinary people who are more concerned about your glory, your strength, and what you do than what they do. Help us be men like that. Help us be women like that. Help us be children like that. That we might make an impact on this world for your glory. We ask this in your name. Amen.